Good morning. It feels weird starting a sermon not with saying good morning to people. Don't know why, it's what we do. I do want to start out by saying, by apologizing in advance to you half over here. When you're preaching, when you're speaking in front of people, you want to, you know, spread the love, give attention to everyone. But it's a little crowded over here, so you naturally gravitate away from the crowding. That's just how it happens, so I apologize in advance. I'm not ignoring you guys. That's just how it tends to happen. So just so you know, I'm not ignoring you. It's, you know, as much to you as to you guys. But so raise your hand if you are married. I'll put my hand down here because I'm not. So keep your hand up. Raise your hand if you're seeing someone or dating or talking, or I ask you and you say, I don't know, maybe, possibly, it's complicated. Okay. And for those of you who are neither of those categories, that's where I am. It's okay. It's fine. We have cats. We have dogs. It's whatever. But those of you who don't, you have friends, right? You have close friendships. Women probably more so than men. That's just how it happens. But you have friends. And when you have these friends, when you have these spouses, these significant others, you spend time with them. And when you spend time with them, you open up to them. Women, again, more so than men. Guys, as long as there's a game on, we're fine. But you spend time with them, you open up to them. And if the other person is not there, they seem checked out, they seem not present, it bothers you a little bit, right? You know, women, when you're pouring out your heart to your guy, to your man, or maybe to your other women, and they're checking their phone, or they're, you know, watching the game, or if they're just spacing out, as we tend to do, it bothers you a little bit. Men, when you're trying to share a joke or tell a funny story for the 17th time, and the wife's not listening, or she finishes the story for you so she can get back to what she's doing around whatever, like, it bothers you a little bit, right? Because you feel like they're not present with you, they're not there with you. And there's a lot of reasons for that, depending on who you are, but one of the key reasons is because we're meant to be present in creation where we've been placed. We're meant to be present with each other in creation where we've been placed. And so when you're bothered because the person you're with, the person you're on some level trying to open up to, be vulnerable with, when they're not present with you, that's actually your mind, your body, your spirit saying something's not right, because we're supposed to be present with each other. That being said, there's a deeper level to everything. While we're meant to be present in creation, it's not supposed to end there. We're meant to be present in creation, present with each other in creation, because that's one of the big ways God has chosen to reveal himself to us. So if you're present in creation, and by creation, I don't just mean nature. I don't mean out looking at trees or watching waterfalls, but, you know, we are created beings. So that's present with each other. That's present in buildings together, because buildings are a product of God's creation. So just in this, we'll call it plane of existence to make it sound deep and mystical and whatever. We're meant to be here because this is where and the way that God has chosen to reveal himself to us. That's how we learn things about God. If you sit in a room by yourself with nothing around you, it's God will still reveal himself to you, but it's a lot easier to see things about God when you go out and you look at Niagara Falls, or you know, talk with people and you see how people are and how people operate, or, you know, there's lots of different ways. But God has chosen to reveal himself through creation, so we need to be present in creation. The issue that people run into, the issue that I run into, that I imagine at least a couple of you run into, imagine that basically every person in here has run into since the beginning of time, is when we are not present in a healthy way, in a good way, where we are, we miss what God is trying to reveal to us. We miss the bigger picture of what is happening. And that's happened. That's basically the story of Israel's history right out the gate. We're going to look at, you don't have to flip to it, I'm just going to tell you briefly. So Israel, if you don't know, if you missed the entire first half of this big book here, it was, God chose a man. This man was a dusty old man. I mean, he was older than dirt. And his wife was not quite as old, but still older than dirt. And he said, you know what? You're too old to have kids, so I'm going to make a nation out of you. And then so he, of course, did his God thing. And after Abraham screwed it up multiple times trying to do his own thing, God said, I'm still going to give you a son. He took that son and he gave him a son. And then he made people and people and people. And, you know, kind of like how rabbits do, they multiplied. And over the course of this, they were ended up moving to Egypt. And Egypt, there's a lot of things happening there. They were enslaved there. And then God led them out of that slavery, just doing little things like sending massive plagues, turning the world's largest river red, you know, doing little things like that, and then helped them walk across an entire gulf of ocean on dry ground and then closing it back up, you know, just little things that God does, the day-to-day, whatever. And then he brought them to a mountain, and he said, you're a scattered group of people. I'm going to unite you. I'm going to give you purpose. I'm going to give you structure. I'm going to do what no other God in history has done and tell you what I expect from you, what I want from you. You're not just at the mercy of my whims. And so they, you know, screwed up at points along the way periodically, as people do, but he did that. He brought him out of that. He brought him to this place, and he told them, I'm going to give you this place. This place is beautiful. It's incredible. It's yours for the taking. It's on a silver platter. Here you go. And this is where Israelites did what Israelites do best. They were blinded to the spiritual realities by their presence, their present context. So they did what they did, and they sent 12 people in, because it's always got to be 12 with Israel, because, you know, that's kind of the way it is. So they sent people in to look at the land, look how beautiful the land is, how are they going to take the land. They came back, and two of them said, dude, it's ours, it's beautiful, it's great. They got grapes this big around, like it's milk and honey forever. It's perfect. All we got to do is take it. God's given it to us. And the other 10 people said, well, you know what? We're a scattered group of people. We have no organization, no function. We've all been making bricks for all our lives. We don't know how to fight. These people are giants, trained warriors. They have huge walls. And so Israelites did what Israelites do best, and they were blinded to the spiritual realities of what God was doing, and they decided to not take the land that God was giving to them. So they missed the fact that despite the fact that they were this unorganized, scattered group of people, God was telling them, I'm doing something amazing here. I'm continuing this work that I've started. I'm giving this to you. All you have to do is take it. And they missed it, completely blind to that fact. And so if you read the rest of the Old Testament, you're going to see fallout from that incident, and you're going to see time and time again where Israelites missed what God was doing because they were blinded by some earthly need or some context or some tradition or you name it, they were blinded by it. And so we're going to fast forward a little bit, skip a couple hundred years, and we're going to end up in John. That's where we're going to be today. But before we get to John 10, where we are, we're going to look at John 5. For those of you who are thinking 5 comes before 10, that means we've already heard about John 5. That's true. We're just going to flash back briefly and see that the problem has not gone away. So beginning of John 5, Jesus is, he's in the middle of his ministry. He's going around, he's teaching, he's healing, he's doing all these incredible things. And he sees this man who's been lame for 38 years. No, that doesn't mean he was a stick in the mud for a long time. It means he could not walk for 38 years. And it was so bad that he was sitting right next to a pool and he couldn't get himself into the pool. Okay, so Jesus does what Jesus does and he heals the man. He says, take your mat and go do your business. So the guy does what he does. He can't walk for 38 years, so he picks up his mat and walks away. And the Jews see that, and their first response is not, wow, that man's healed. It's not, who did that? It's not even, wow, only the power of demons could have done that. No, the Jews' response is, are you kidding me? It is the Sabbath day. You can't do work on the Sabbath day, and picking up your mat is work. Because that's what we all would do, too. If you saw someone speeding down the street, you'd say, hey, I know you were blind for 38 years, and you can drive now, that's all fine and dandy, but you can't speed, okay? That's against the rules. The Jews continue this issue, and it's the crazy thing is it's the leaders. Well, worst of all, the Jewish leaders who should have had the, they should have been closest to see what God was seeing because they knew the law, they studied the law, they saw. In case you don't know what the law was, it wasn't just Exodus and Numbers and Leviticus where it's sacrificed this animal on this day for this reason. No, it was the entire Old Testament, which is nothing but here's what God did amazing, and here's how people screwed it up, and here's how God fixed it. So they see this, they know the entire history, and they miss it. So that's the kind of people Jesus is dealing with. So we're going to be in John chapter 10. If you want to go ahead and turn there, if you're not already. I was last minute with telling the tech guys the slide, so I don't know if there's a slide made up or not for it, but We're going to be in the last half of John chapter 10. We're going to start in verse 31, but before that, we're going to look at verse 22, because John gives a key piece of context here. But before we look at that, a lot of you are probably wondering why the history lesson. It's to show a pattern of people, and if you don't believe me that that pattern is still the case, let's look at yourselves. There's a lot of ways we could go with this. There's a lot of ways we miss what God's doing because of how our life goes. One of the easiest ones to think of is money. How many of y'all have money? A couple of you, I imagine. I mean, you could afford gas to get here. So I imagine at least have $3 to your name, because that's almost a gallon of gas. There's probably a lot of you that have had points where money's tight. There's probably a lot of you who know someone who, either because they lost their job or because there was a medical thing that you know, bills are expensive, or because there was a house disaster, one reason or another, I imagine a lot of you know someone who had money really tight. Like, I mean, they're not sure how they're going to get food in their belly by the end of the week. And I imagine a lot of you who know someone like that, some of those people stayed faithful through it. They continued to give sacrificially, not just in the offering plate, but to people. And they were generous and opened their homes and their pantries. And they stayed faithful, and God blessed them. And then for one reason or another, he chose out of the mercy of his heart to give these people a job or to sustain them in this period of joblessness. And we look at those people and we say, wow, that's amazing. God did this great thing. That's awesome. But I got to make sure all my I's are dotted and T's are crossed and all the dollars line up so that I can afford to make it through next month, and God doesn't even factor into the equation. I imagine there's a couple of you who could reconcile with that, who could empathize with that, who've been in that situation, or maybe it's a medical thing. Maybe you look at someone who this disease, whatever it was, had them, like, I knew a girl in high school, and over the course of a couple months, went from just, you know, normal as could be to she couldn't move from the neck down. And there was over the prayers and prayers and prayers. And one night, she was healed. She just got up and could walk. Doctors couldn't tell you any reason. They had no idea. She just walked up in the middle of the night, walked to her dad and said, I'm all better now. So we hear stories like that occasionally, and we think, man, I got to make sure that my body's a perfect specimen so that I don't get sick. And God doesn't factor into the equation. We tend to be blinded to what God could possibly be doing because we're so concerned and we're so unaware of the spiritual realities, the bigger realities of things, because we're so caught up in the day-to-day of life, of history, tradition, of you name it, and we've probably been blinded by it. So it's not just the dusty old Israelites with the long beards and the funny robes who lived in the desert that had that problem. It's us nowadays. But that's only part of the issue. But we're going to look at John chapter 10, and we're going to see how Jesus handles people being spiritually blind. And in verse 22, John tells us that this happened during the Feast of Dedication. Now, for those of you who don't know, that's Hanukkah. And I can't say it. Nathan could say it better than I can. I can't really do the phlegm thing. Nathan's been studying Hebrew, so he's got those weird, funny sounds. I think Israelites and Jews just have better sounding holidays than we do. Hanukkah, Rosh Hashanah, and we have Easter, St. Patrick's Day. I don't know. Not as fun names. That's beside the point. Anyway, I just thought about that, and that's funny. But so Hanukkah. If you don't know what Hanukkah is, it's probably because it's not talked about anywhere in the Old Testament. It's not a festival that was established in the Old Testament when the Jews were still a whole country of Israel. This was something that happened in the one page between the end of Malachi and the beginning of Matthew, where there was like 400 years of events that happened that we don't talk about in here. What happened was, over the course of that time, Israel was, they had screwed up time and time again. They had been unfaithful time and time again. So God had subjugated them, and they were taken over by this man called Alexander the Great. He was, you know, kind of a big deal, largest kingdom at the time, took over the whole Mediterranean. It's whatever, it's casual, you know, just an afternoon. So he had control of Israel, and then things happened. He died because, you know, people die, and then it was split among four people. Anyway, long story short, the Israelites are controlled by this Greek dude, and this Greek dude died. So then his son takes over. Well, you know, people were people, politics were politics, it hasn't changed, and religious authorities were religious authorities, And long story short, it happened that some people were upset with other people, so they went to the governor. The governor came in, took over Jerusalem, took over the temple. And he did the worst thing he could possibly think of, and he took a pig, which we think bacon, the Jews think incredibly unclean, ceremonially unclean, don't put that anywhere near the temple. He brought it into the temple, and he sacrificed it on the altar. It's kind of a big deal. It'd be like walking on Sunday morning and someone's sitting in the seat you sat in for 30 years. Like, that's unacceptable. We draw the line. Can't do that. I'm a little passionate about assigned seats. It's whatever. And so God raised up this man, Mattathias. Mattathias had 5 sons. They started a rebellion. Mattathias died, as people do. His son took over. Judah was his name. They called him Judah the Hammer, Judah Maccabeus. I don't know if you've heard of him. You're like, that name sounds vaguely familiar. It was no big deal what he did. He just kicked out the Greeks of Jerusalem. He took back the place, took back the temple. They had a big celebration, rededicated the temple to the Lord. That's what Hanukkah is. It's memorial of that. Okay. You'll see in a little bit the irony of why John points out this is happening during Hanukkah. But let's get down to the text that we're going to read today. Because that's kind of why you're here, is to hear the Bible read. We do that occasionally, don't worry. So we're going to start in verse 31. If you want to turn there, cool. These guys are incredible and work on short notice, which is great for me. So, starting in verse 31, before verse 31, for those of you who have missed the last couple weeks, Jesus does this thing, okay? It's a little thing. It's no big deal. But he walks up. He does this time and time again. He says, how can I push the buttons of the leaders? And I'm going to go push those buttons repeatedly, and then they're going to try to kill me. I'm going to escape, and then I'm going to do it all over again. Basically, it's like he's married to the Jewish leaders, okay? He's the husband, they're the wife. He says, what buttons can I push? I know exactly what buttons to push. He pushes them. They try to kill him. Things are thrown. Vases are thrown. He avoids them. It's, you know. So, this has just happened. He's just made some claims that the Jews are very upset about. They try to kill him. He escapes. He says some things again, and that brings us to verse 31. He's just said some things that they're upset with, namely, he is God, is what he's claiming. And so the Jews picked up stones to stone him. And he replies to this, I have shown you many good works from the Father. For which of them are you going to kill me? And they said, it's not for any good thing that you've done. It's not for any good work that you've done that we're going to stone you, but it's because you committed blasphemy. Because you, who are just a man, claim that you're the Son of God. And his response is as great a response as Jesus could give. He says, isn't it written in your law, I said, you are gods? If he called them gods to whom the word of God came, and scripture can't be broken, do you say of him whom the Father consecrated and sent into the world, you are blaspheming because I am the Son of God? Now, for those of you who are confused as to what's happening and why in the world God referred to people as Son of God, he's referencing a psalm here, Psalm 82. We're not going to read through it. It's one of those psalms, if you like nerding out on things, read the commentaries, because it's a bunch of very smart men disagreeing and providing the same evidence for completely polar opposite arguments. It's great. It's a good time to read. Anyway, what is happening here is the psalmist is quoting God speaking to, depending on who you read, some audience or another, but at least on some level, he's speaking to the judges of Israel, the leaders of Israel, and he's saying, this isn't in a good way, but he's saying, I said, you are gods, sons of the Most High, all of you. Nevertheless, like men, you shall die and fall like any prince. So he's calling them gods, but not in a good way. But according to Jesus' understanding, he is calling gods the people who have received the word. So if Jesus says it, I'm going to run with it, and we're going to call it good. And if you have disagreements, you can ask Nathan or Adam, and we'll go from there. So Jesus is saying, by your logic, I've committed blasphemy because I called myself God. Well, in the very law that you live by to a T and that you're claiming to condemn me, God calls the people who have received his word gods. He says, you are gods. So if they're gods, I'm not just receiving the word. I am the word. I am the man sent by God, set apart from God to do these things. How is it blasphemy that I'm referring to myself as the Son of God? But he seems like he's gonna leave it there. And then he says, if I'm not doing the works of my Father, then do not believe me. if my actions don't match my words, don't believe me. Because that's what he calls the Jewish leaders out for. Often their actions and their words don't match. If I am not doing the works of my Father, then don't believe me. But if I do them, even though you don't believe me, believe the works, that you may know and understand that the Father is in me and I am in the Father. What he's saying is, I've made these claims, and I have a list that I stole that Adam made last week, and these are claims that Jesus has made. He's saying, if you don't believe these, if you have a problem with these, if these make you want to stone me or kill me or arrest me or do whatever you want to do, then at least look at what I've done and believe those things. Look at the people I've raised from the dead. Look at the people who were lame for 38 years and I made walk. Look at the people who I gave sight to. Look at the people who I healed the disease. There's a long list of things he's done. Not even his teachings, but look at the things he's done. If nothing about those things is good for the betterment of people from the Father, then absolutely don't believe him. But he's saying, if you look at these actions, at least believe them. At least believe that this man was lame for 38 years and I made him walk. At least believe this man was blind since birth and I gave him sight. Not because of me, but because of the Father setting me aside, which that speaks to his humility, which is the whole other sermon series. That's what he's saying. That's all well and good. So he's telling these Jews, you don't believe me, which makes no sense because I am the embodiment of the word that you've been given and that you know and that you study. But if you don't believe the words I speak, if you don't believe the teachings I teach, if you have a problem making these the whole law connect with me, then at least look at what I've done and believe. Now, if you're wondering what all this has to do with being married and your spouse checking out in conversation, we're going to tie it all back together now. This is the grand wrap-up. If you watch any detective TV show, this is where they make all the pieces fit, and you're like, oh, it makes some. Obviously, everyone knew it was him, even though you had no idea. In case you're wondering, I live my life through TV shows, so it's fine. It's all well and good. So, these Jews, they're missing the big picture. Oh, I talked about we were going to see the irony of it taking place during Hanukkah. So Hanukkah, celebration of God leading a rebellion to take back the temple and rededicating his people and consecrating his people. Jesus is doing the exact same thing. He's coming in, he's leading a spiritual rebellion to rededicate his people, reconsecrate his people, and bring people back to the Lord and rededicate his people to the Lord. But the difference is Judah led a physical, earthly, political rebellion. There were actual people that died. There was an actual place that was being taken. And there was an actual altar to be rededicated. In Jesus' case, he's leading a spiritual rebellion, so there's no one actually dying by his hand. There's no physical place being retaken by his sword, and there's no physical altar being rededicated. He is the altar. We are the place. That's a whole, you can extrapolate from there. And that's a big word. I went to college, folks. So he's leading a spiritual rebellion, but the people are so blind. They've been so blinded by traditions, by laws, by an immense history of all sorts of issues that you can read that goes past Malachi and up to John. They're so blinded by this world around them, by their views of themselves, by their views of God that are incorrect, that they're missing the fact that God is doing the exact same thing, which they're actually celebrating, and they're missing it. They are completely blind to it, missing it all. By a mile. Not only do they not think that he's the Son of God come to save all mankind, but they actually think he's either a lunatic or of the devil. So, what does that have to do with us? We've already established we can be spiritually blind. So, now's the time when a lot of people get up and say, okay, so go do this, go do that, go do the other, and you'll be good. That'll fix your blindness. John seems to believe the solution to blindness is belief. Well, how do you believe? You got to know. You got to know God. And then that leads to belief, which leads to more knowledge. It's a back and forth. But he calls us to believe. Well, how do we believe? How do we get to know him? Well, he's revealed himself to us through this creation that we're meant to be present in. So, you study creation, not just you go out and look at nature. I mean, you can look at Niagara Falls. It's just water. And you can look at a glass that you filled from the fridge. It's just water. They're both water. That's exciting. You can look at creation. You study philosophers. You study this, that, and the other. The Bible, the teachers, all that jazz. There's a lot to learn about God. But ultimately, that's only part of it. Knowledge doesn't mean belief. I mean, these men, these Jewish leaders, literally right out the womb, they were handed the scroll and said, here you go, learn this. They had the entire Pentateuch, the first five books, memorized by the time they were like five or six. And I forget my favorite verse sometimes, so that's embarrassing. But so these men, they knew, they had knowledge. That wasn't the issue. The issue was they were spiritually blind. And so Jesus provides a solution. He says, just believe in what I've done. Believe in what the Lord has done. Believe in what God has done. And then that will reveal who he is. So belief is not just an issue. We're a couple weeks from now. We got Easter coming up. It's just kind of a big deal. I mean, you don't get presents unless you're, you know, five or below. But it's a big holiday. It's as believers, it's the holiday we're made to celebrate. It's God sent his son. His son died. And he came to life. But that's not all. That's not all God's done in history. If you want to jump back to the beginning, he made a place. It's called the earth. I don't know if you've heard of it. You live there, though. So he made this earth. And then he made people. People are incredibly intricate. They're incredibly just amazing. And he made these people. And then guess what these people did? They done messed up. They had this perfect relationship with the Lord, with God the Father, who came down and walked with them in this garden that was perfection, and they said it wasn't enough, so he disciplined them as a loving father does, and then they had kids, those kids screwed up, and he disciplined them as a loving father does, but he redeemed it, and then those people screwed up, and back and forth, and back and forth, and so he said this isn't working, so he sent a flood that took out the whole world. And he started up a new lineage, and then that still didn't work because people continued to mess up. And so he said, I'm going to make a people that are my people. They're designated to me. I'm going to call them out. I'm going to let them know I have a special relationship with them. And it started with Adam, that dusty old fart who shouldn't have been able to have kids, but he ended up fathering a whole nation. And then he did that. He brought them to this place that was this incredible place they should have never lived in because they shouldn't have been able to take it. And he gave it to them. And then guess what? They screwed it up again because they were blind to what he was doing because they were so caught up in their reality. So he just, you know, continually sent in people to discipline them, and then they came back to him and he redeemed them and did these incredible things, and then he disciplined them because they screwed up, and back and forth and back and forth. And so finally he said, you know what? Well, I say finally, he's outside of time, so that's a whole other theological discussion. Anyway, he sent his son. He sent himself in human form, not just to die. He did a lot of things before he died. He experienced pain, physical pain, emotional pain. He experienced heartbreak. He experienced loss. He experienced love, which he already had experienced, but it's on a different level. He experienced love. He experienced hunger, thirst. I mean, dude was walking alone in the wilderness with no food for 40 days. His tummy was a rumbling. So he did that, and then he got this band of disciples together, and he taught people, and he healed people, and some of the people he healed rejected him, and some of the people who had known him since he was a kid rejected him. Talk about pain and betrayal and heartbreak. And then these people he got together, and one of his closest friends, one of his closest disciples, sold him out for money to the people who had been trying to kill him. So after all this work of trying to draw these people in to show these people the light, they killed him, not just in an easy way, but in an embarrassing, a shameful, a painful way. That didn't stop him. He then rose from the dead, didn't die again. That's incredible, but that's not where the story ends. That's not all he did. Easter is amazing. I literally can't downplay the importance of the cross and the empty tomb. I've read books by men who are like 80 years old, and they've been studying it their whole life, and they still don't have a handle on how grand thing it is. So it's a big deal. But that's not where it ends. He then sent his Holy Spirit into this people who were kind of ignorant, like they were fishermen and carpenters and tax collectors. They didn't do much with their life, and somehow they started a church that, I don't know if you've heard of it, it's called the Christian Church. It's kind of a big deal in some parts of the world. It's taken over, and they've done terrible things that God has redeemed. They've done great things. It's led to healing people. It's led to great charities being done, great works being done, people coming together, relationships, forgiveness, all through the power of the Holy Spirit. So that's kind of a big deal. And that's not all. We don't believe in God for that. We don't believe in God because he did these incredible things. We don't believe who God is. We don't say he's great because he did this. He's not great because he did that. He's not good or bad because he didn't do this, that, or the other. He is good. He has done these things. so that we may see him and begin to know him and have an inkling of how great and merciful and kind and forgiving and strong and forgiving and loving and disciplining and forgiving. Like, it's kind of a big deal in the Bible, is his forgiveness. So we look at these things he's done, these incredible things he's done. And all he calls us to do is believe. Believe in him. As Jesus says, if you don't believe the words I say at face value, then look at the works that I've done, look at the works that God has done, and believe that I and the Father are one. Believe that God sent himself in the form of Jesus, not to die, not so that we can go on and live hoity-toity in heaven after we die off this earth, but so that from the moment we are born, he has given us the possibility, the capability to walk with him daily, to find out, to be exposed to just how great and magnificent he is. And then we get on our deathbed and we realize we didn't even scratch the surface. We are called to believe in him. That's why he does what he does. That's why we are called. That's why, jump it all back to the beginning of the sermon, that's why we are made to be present in creation, is because he's worked in creation so that we may believe in him. We're going to wrap it up because if we skip over a couple verses, it's kind of a big deal sometimes. So we're going to wrap it up with the last three verses of the book of John, chapter 10, not the book of John. There's things happen afterwards. So Jesus, after he escapes from these people who are blind to the reality of what he's trying to do for them, not for him, but for them, and they try to kill him, he escapes. It says, he went away across the Jordan to the place where John had been baptizing, John the Baptist had been baptizing at first, and there he remained. And many came to him. And they said, John did no sign, but everything that John said about this man was true. And many believed in him there. Question is, are you going to be one of the many?